The Foreign Service needs to make a concerted effort to acknowledge America's difficult history at home before we attempt to encourage others abroad to be democratic.
And welcome to Insights from Abroad. This podcast is brought to you by the Office of Global Perspectives and International Initiatives at the University of Central Florida. Our mission is to support international academic programs at UCF. My name is Abigail Bass. Today, I am joined by Ambassador Harriet Elam Thomas to discuss the role of U.S. diplomacy during crisis. Ambassador Elam Thomas, thank you for joining us remotely today.
My pleasure.
So that our listeners are aware, Ambassador Elam Thomas was UCF's diplomat in residence from 2003 to 2005 under a U.S. State Department program. Until 2005, she served as a senior foreign service officer with the rank of career minister. As a foreign service officer, she has held positions such as U.S. ambassador to Senegal, country affairs officer for Greece, Turkey, and Cyprus, as well as other positions in France, Mali, and the Ivory Coast. Ambassador Elam Thomas has received various awards for her service, including the U.S. Government's Superior Honor Award and the Director General's Cup of the U.S. Department of State. She is the author of Diversifying Diplomacy, My Journey from Roxbury to Dakar. Presently, she directs the diplomacy program at UCF. Before we discuss the crises of the day, I wanted to ask you about your work at UCF. Ambassador Elam Thomas, as a former diplomat in residence and as the director of the diplomacy program, you have done a great deal to make information and advice regarding diplomatic work accessible at UCF. Could you explain your personal mission for this program and why was it important to you that students understand the significance of diplomacy?
Well, Abigail, many Americans are woefully uninformed about diplomacy and often through no fault of their own. Unlike the U.S. military, the State Department does not have bases throughout the United States. So we don't have a built-in constituency. And the bases often provide jobs for the surrounding communities. And almost every American family has someone who has served in the military at some point over the past two generations. They understand the term military, but few understand the term diplomat. And perhaps the only image they have of a diplomat is a gray-haired man in a pinstripe suit, one who, in their mind, frequents cocktail parties and receptions. And despite the internet, most Americans are at a disadvantage because we are bounded by two oceans on the east and west coasts. And we, even when we travel from state to state, we don't have to be fluent or even conversant in another language. Perhaps an accent, but that's about it. So I hope that I've been able to provide insight on the practical aspects of diplomacy to a new generation of international civil and foreign servants. I hope that they will be culturally sensitive. I hope they'll study the history of non-Western as well as Western civilizations. And I hope they will be respectful of all humanity.
I believe we can all agree that we are currently undergoing a difficult moment in America's and the world's history. So let's start with the coronavirus pandemic. While many businesses and public centers have begun reopening, the pandemic continues on, with Florida reporting a new record of more than 4,000 new cases in one day. First of all, how has the pandemic affected your work personally?
Well, the pandemic has heighten the awareness of our interdependent world. It also has highlighted the deleterious effect of our approach to the disease, to the virus, because we were woefully unprepared. The absence of central and unified instructions using the Constitution and our federalist nature of the country as a justification for the absence of universal guidelines. What we have seen transpired in the States has allowed all of us to approach the STEM, really kept us from approaching the STEM of the spread of the virus. The lack of PPE at the outset to our inaccurate and insufficient testing, the refusal to follow the rules to wear the mask. Then we have something called internet disinformation, all different kinds of treatments. Very often people who are less informed will take those as gospel. And fortunately, because I can work remotely, I recognize how blessed I am, when in fact, there are others who don't have that luxury. But because of the pandemic, I can stay in touch with the students and mentees. And I'm also able to attend many webinars, which help me correct many of the misperceptions that may exist about the pandemic. I'm not a scientist, but these webinars address other international issues relevant to the United States. And it also gives me a chance to follow the international media and see how America is viewed from abroad. The Cuomo briefings were followed, I learned, from friends around the world in the United States, in Africa and in Australia. And then my work, which is largely done electronically now, has meant a few too many hours on this computer, Zoom meetings and webinars. But I feel a duty to remain informed so that I can provide accurate information to the students. Too much time on the PC, however, has been a little detrimental to one's health in terms of exercise. So I have to remember to stand and move around and clear my head from time to time.
Within the field of diplomacy, it is undeniable that developing interpersonal relationships is an inherent part of the job. COVID-19 has limited people's ability to connect. How would you say the pandemic has changed diplomatic interactions? And how can diplomats continue to build relationships in the wake of such changes?
Undeniably, I will say it's been significant. The absence of face-to-face communication and interaction is terribly detrimental to our ability to develop sincere relationships. I often would tell my students the importance of eye contact. Well, we can still have eye contact, but you get no idea, especially if you're wearing a mask. It is difficult, if not impossible. So now diplomats must be extremely careful in their written communication. Words matter, and how you use them in a document matter even more. Electronic messages often do not provide the cover of a filter, and I've even forced myself to reread messages that I send, so that people do not get the incorrect impression. I'll be very candid also and say the shorthand used in Twitter feeds and Facebook responses disturb me. What does like really mean? Or one or two words on Facebook or the 147 characters that you use on Twitter, it's just a bit too much of a shortcut for me. And the Twitter comments cannot convey intricate knowledge of any subject. It seldom demonstrates a genuine sensitivity to a new or different culture. Writers must pay very special attention to how they craft their messages in order not to insult, albeit unintentionally, their interlocutors. Witness the problems we've seen from the feeds from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. And also, how can diplomats resolve conflicts during the pandemic responses if we hope that the United States might have learned lessons from Italy and Spain? Several US governors had to step up and do their best to ramp up the hospital bed capacity. And the United States and other governments witnessed how quickly China built a large hospital bed facility in 10 days or less than 2 weeks. So we've got much to learn still.
Leading off that question, in an interview discussing your role as the US ambassador to Senegal, you stated, "The manner in which you deliver a message is as important as the words you use." Due to the pandemic, diplomatic correspondence has taken place via electronic communications or behind a mask. Because of this, many communication cues have been somewhat discounted. Do you feel that this change strains the ability to develop relationships, or does it open a new avenue for more creative ways to develop relationships in an increasingly digital world?
I've tried to think about that because, as I mentioned a bit earlier, it's very hard to smile or to grimace, and the message does not come across when you have a mask on. For instance, the memory I have when I was ambassador to Senegal during the 9/11 tragedy was one that is almost as serious in my memory as some others I'm going to talk about a bit later. All of the NATO allies came to help us. But that was because we were able to have face-to-face contact with our interlocutors at the UN. And Article 5 was instituted, in which every one of the nations came to America's aid. If we had to rely only on telegrams or electronic communications, and that might have been at risk right after September 11th, I'm not quite sure we would have been as effective. Communications really rely also on body language, on your being able to share your in-depth knowledge about the historical baggage that your counterparts bring to a meeting table. And I'm not sure you can do all that electronically. You have to be able to sit and talk with them over a cup of tea or coffee, or perhaps a glass of wine. And that is precisely why we had representation budgets throughout my career in the Foreign Service, because people are far more relaxed if they're having a dinner. Well, that's not possible anymore. So I do believe that our colleagues are challenged overseas to be able to establish relationships, genuine ones, at this point.
Let's shift to the role of diplomacy in times of international crisis. As the pandemic is an international issue, there have been various conflicts between nations regarding proper pandemic response. How can diplomats work to resolve such conflicts, especially given the sensitive nature of the pandemic response?
Well, I can stop and think of how we helped so many nations during the Ebola crisis, how American ambassadors, some of whom I know very well, were in the staging operations to get PPE to all parts of West Africa. None of them jumped ship and said, this is too much, I don't want to get sick, I'm going home. No, they stayed at their posts, and they were effective in making sure that the medicines and the staging equipment got to posts nearby. I think of Liberia as one of those countries. I am not so sure that we can do that again based only on internet communication. It is indeed possible to use the telephone for sure. The inflection in one's voice can come across in phone conversations. Yes, we have Zoom, we have GoToMeeting, and we have all the other Skype and other ways in which we can communicate. Those can be a pretty good substitute. And I will say in their favor, it eliminates some of the fluff that you might have if you're sitting in a cocktail party and you know you really need to go in that conference room and meet. If you're seated right there with a designated amount of time to cover the issue, you will be focused. So that perhaps we can say that there are positive outcomes as a result of using electronic media, even in diplomacy.
On to the role of organizations during times of crisis. In May, U.S. President Donald Trump announced plans to leave the World Health Organization, the WHO. First, in your words, what is the importance of international organizations in such times of crisis?
No one country can live and survive on its own. We needed the help of other nations and our allies, not only right after September 11th, but in order to get equipment to countries during the Ebola and other international, either climate change, hurricanes, tsunamis. We all know in each instance, we were able often to be the linchpin for the distribution of equipment throughout these crises. Our medical doctors are willing to go wherever they are needed. Whether you're from Asia, Africa, or Latin America, if you have an expertise, you are indeed committed and often much more motivated than Joe Blow's citizen who has been reading about the subject to get into a plane and reach the destination to make a specific impact. Well, you can't do that now. But international organizations like the World Health Organization are responsible for keeping people alive. And if you can't get the food delivered because America, which is one of the largest donor organizations, countries, to the sites, in the medicine, in the food, so many people already at-risk populations will suffer even more. So we have to realize that our desire to do things alone is not being very, very sensitive to others. And if we want to be a country in a world in which has less conflict, we need to be part and parcel of the World Health Organization.
Leading off of that question, what degree of influence do you believe international organizations should exert in times of crisis? And how can diplomats mediate conflicts regarding such disagreements about the role of organizations?
Well, for instance, we were frustrated that the World Health Organization didn't push China on whether or not why they didn't push China to provide more information on the coronavirus at the outset when China knew about it in January of 2020. If we were much more active at the tables of discussions, we could have pushed for that. But we may not have been at, this was before we pulled out, but this again reminds us as to why it's important to be there present to state our position and have our voices heard. If you're not in the room, it sounds a bit trite, but you can't be heard. So the fact that we didn't have representatives or we were not able to influence the discussions of the World Health Organization to push them to push China, I think it's a travesty. And that is one of the reasons why international organizations need the involvement of countries around the world. We really can't rule by what we, the United States, deems important. We've got to learn to listen to others because we are not the be-all, as I've said in my book, and the end-all of civilization. We may be the strongest power in the world, but China and India are still competing with us.
You mentioned in an interview that as a diplomat, you learned when to push an issue and when to exhibit the utmost patience. How can diplomats understand the time and place for when to push an issue and when to be more patient? And as an expert in diplomacy, what are your thoughts on the U.S. departure from the WHO?
When you think of diplomacy, you almost need to always remember that patience is part and parcel of it. Respect, humility are also important. Americans tend to be always wanting to have instant gratification. It's the nature of our Western industrialization. The faster we can do things, the better. Well, I learned that when I was overseas, if something was broken, people didn't have a nervous hissy fit about it. They dealt with it and said, oh, it will get fixed. And I used to do a speech saying how much I used to be terribly frustrated when the term inshallah was used, when God is willing. Well, guess what? We're learning how to be patient now with the pandemic. And we as a country have to understand that Rome was not built in a day. And it will take time to build not only credibility, but a sincere rapport with our interlocutors. We must learn to listen with intention and listen with empathy. And at times, even for me, that's hard to do. But that's one of the key things that is missing and are not being in the WHO right now.
shift to the issue of racism and police brutality in the U.S. You speak frequently in your book, Diversifying Diplomacy, about you and your family's experiences with racism. For example, your grandparents left Aiken County, South Carolina, to raise their family due to the racist effects of Reconstruction and Jim Crow laws. And you have discussed your own experiences with discrimination as well. Firstly, could you share your own thoughts on the recent protests and movements?
I must say, as devastating as it was to watch the death of George Floyd, it is what I consider America's Emmett Till moment. Many of you may be too young to know who that was, but I will never forget seeing the cover of Jet magazine with the brutalized face of this 13 or 14 year old child in the casket. In my view, I see a reason for hope because of the involvement of the entire society, Black, white, LGBTQ, everyone from communities around the country that may not have a large minority population. And I think of when I left the U.S. Information Agency as the acting director, I wrote a note saying that I frequently found myself in an anomalous position as an African American during my career as a Foreign Service officer. Because in all of my assignments abroad, I was charged with representing and describing American society to foreign publics. And I was pleased and honored to take on that responsibility, which I considered an almost sacred trust. Now, I will admit it's a heady feeling when you meet people abroad and they say to you, you are truly the United States of America. But that same society that I represented, however, was one which then and still now, in which racism has played all too much of a pervasive role. The genuine diversity that we've witnessed, as I said, in the recent protests, gives me not just a glimmer, but much hope. But it's tempered by the fundamental need for a host of American institutions to be changed, not just the police department. We must ensure true diversity on school boards, city councils, real estate firms, banking organizations, investment firms, local and state and federal offices, the judicial system, the media, and in corporate America. We're seeing signs of that. But again, I want to see these institutions walk the walk and just not talk the talk. Writers are quick to mention comments about looting. And I must say, I appreciated reading former Secretary Robert Reich's comments saying a decade ago, Wall Street bankers looted America through the predatory lending and securities fund. American households lost $19 trillion of net worth. No Wall Street banker was sent to prison. They got a bailout. The billionaires lobbied for and received bailouts, and the executives took home massive bonuses. That's the kind of looting. But again, that's the double standard, and that does not always reach the press, but I was very happy to see a former Secretary of Labor make that observation.
You mentioned in your memoir the moment you heard of Dr. Martin Luther King's assassination and how your hometown of Roxbury in Boston broke out into protest, as many other urban areas did. Could you share your own experiences with how that event relates to the current protests of today? And as a diplomat, how important is it to you that young activists understand the history of racism and the civil rights movement in the United States?
We often state, if we do not know where we've been, we will not know where we're going. Most Jewish children learn of the Holocaust at a very young age. And that heinous evidence of man's inhumanity to man is instilled in every Jewish person I know. They will never forget it. And from my perspective, they are stronger for having learned and remember their history. Sadly, I'll admit that many young Americans, including myself, of many Americans of any hue, and including myself at one point, were not truly aware of the deep-seated roots of slavery. They know little about Reconstruction, Jim Crow, and the May 31st, 1921, Tulsa massacre in which Black Wall Street was devastated. History is critical in understanding how to approach the multifaceted micro and macro aggressions which many people of color must live with in America. And I'm not going to delve into the unconscious and insidious biases which have now been uncovered by our press in the major media outlets. The horrendous death of George Floyd before our eyes, as I said earlier, is today's Emmett Till moment. Because of the need to reflect on our history, many of those listening to the podcast may not know Emmett Till, but America's dark underbelly has now been uncovered.
You have said to me before that as a diplomat, you must work to represent and improve the image of your country, no matter your personal feelings towards your own government's actions. As a diplomat and as a Black woman, how have you reconciled those identities in the face of issues with sexism or racism? And do you have any advice for young women, especially women of color, who aspire to be a Foreign Service officer or diplomat?
I will be very honest and say I don't think I will ever reconcile those identities. I've learned to do what most African-American members of my generation do. We leave our homes each day. We know we can never let our guards down. We must constantly justify our presence in whatever space we may find ourselves. We must be the epitome of decorum, civility, and we must exhibit full command of our portfolio in order to gain and retain the respect of our counterparts. My advice for young men and women of all hues: know your history, be authentic, again, listen with empathy, exhibit humility, respect differences, give more than lip service to the standard phrases about your commitment to diversity. Acknowledge the humanity in every individual you meet.
The United States has tenuous ongoing struggles with civil rights. What role can the Foreign Service play in representing the U.S. in times of social struggles?
The Foreign Service needs to make a concerted effort to acknowledge America's difficult history at home before we attempt to encourage others abroad to be democratic. If we do not live up to the values that we profess and those which are deeply tied to America, then how can we expect others to look up to us? As my colleague Gina, Ambassador Gina Abercrombie Winstanley, eloquently stated in her June 17th testimony before the House Subcommittee on Foreign Affairs, Our problems begin early. And that is the problems of the diplomatic corps, the Foreign Service in the United States. And in spite of a rigorous testing process that brings us smart, highly functional, educated, intelligent, and usually dedicated Foreign Service officers, we do not screen for racists. We do not screen for sexists, and we do not screen for indifference to either. This is a problem rooted in the culture of the building, the Department of State, of course, and the function of the department. No political appointee alone can change that. Gina has been our ambassador to Malta, and I was very happy to see that she, along with Peter Romero, who is of Hispanic descent, were the witnesses before the June 17th House Subcommittee on Foreign Affairs. With their total candor in those hearings, I feel encouraged that will be a movement forward, but it has to be done deep within the very, very subtle ways in which people are treated as they walk through the corridors. You cannot assume that because someone is a Rangel or a Pickering Fellow, that they are any less qualified than those who did not come into the Foreign Service. So there is a stigma that has to be removed. Every single one of the Rangel and Pickering Fellows have to take the same written examination. They go through the same rigorous process, but they are indeed, they are women and they are minorities who are as capable of any of the gentlemen who seem to be the majority, truly are the majority, of the Department of State. In this day and time, with 280 plus embassies around the world, there are only 3 US ambassadors of color. 3. I didn't say 33, 3. And I said there were about 280 embassies abroad. That is indeed a sobering fact that we must deal with.
Finally, I want to wrap our discussion up with more all-encompassing questions. The United States has been considered a world leader of democracy, power, and freedom in the post-Cold War era. With the rise of China and the decline of U.S. participation in international treaties and organizations, some would consider America's role as a world leader to be in decline. In your opinion, do you feel the U.S. government is setting a positive standard for leadership in times of crisis?
My candid and very succinct response to that is no, it is not. And I don't think I need to elaborate on that. Just think of what has transpired. We're no longer members of the climate change agreement we pulled out of the Paris Accord. We have ended the Iran agreement. I can't tell you how many other agreements that we are no longer part of. That said, it's not even realistic to see America as a leader. China and India are indeed rising. We no longer live in a bipolar world. So we must understand that, and we're going to have to work very hard to rebuild America's image abroad.
You have personally navigated crises during your time as a U.S. diplomat and an ambassador. For example, you served in Greece when it was considered a hardship post due to anti-Americanism in the wake of the Cold War, and you received a Group Superior and Meritorious Honor Award for your work in the First Persian Gulf War. What is your personal experience navigating crises, and how would you advise current or aspiring diplomats to handle such challenges?
Knowledge of language and culture is extremely important. And because I knew the languages of the Greeks and the Turks, I was invited to homes, I was invited to events where I didn't have to rely on a third person to transmit a message to me. So the line of communication was never really broken. And I could give them my contact. And I learned to listen. And in many cases, because the verb is at the end of the sentence in Turkish, I had to listen so that I knew what they were going to say, what they were trying to say. It was not easy. It took a very long time. I was in Greece for 4 years and Turkey in 4 years, which again tells you the value of a length of time and not being impatient looking for a result. I also was able to present to the cultures in which I was assigned the view from what was not the majority opinion of America. Many people saw a person, a woman, number one, and a person of color, number two, as the less than American. I wasn't blonde-haired, blue-eyed, and I didn't wear a pinstripe suit. And so they were willing to listen to me, and I had to learn to listen to them. And I would actually say to Greeks who were still very anti-Turk, if it weren't for the changes that took place in American society, I would not be the cultural attaché at this embassy now. So if I can, as a woman of African-American descent, represent the United States here in Greece, I think you can listen more openly to what your Turkish counterparts are saying. Many Greeks felt the Ottoman Empire only ended about a year ago. And they carried that view for so long that it was almost impossible for them to erase. I understood that, but I only understood that because I had to read and learn about that conflict through my training for a year of language training in the Foreign Service, at the Foreign Service Institute. We have to respect the opinion of others, even though we may not agree. That's very hard to do. We must also be willing to share our complete history, as I said earlier, with others. We must be authentic. America is a land of immigrants. Most of what we have that has made America that shining city on the hill is a result of the sacrifices of those who came from some other part of the world. Just think of the names of the Nobel Prize winners, the scientists who are now working diligently on a vaccine for COVID-19. They come from around the world. And as the French intellectual, I love to listen to Bernard Henri Lévy, stated last week on Farid Zakaria's program, the values of America are still there. The real wall that currently exists, he says, is of the division within America. However, when Americans viewed the murder of George Floyd, perhaps because many of us were forced to be inside, the majority of Americans of every race, color, and creed were appalled. They took to the streets and they truly appeared to be committed to full and equal justice for all. That gives me hope. I must remain optimistic because the country will not, I don't want the country to hit the pause button after a few weeks of demonstrations. But I think given the authenticity and the attention of corporate America and communities, which are predominantly white and other affinity groups who've suffered indignities, there is reason for encouragement.
Do you have any closing thoughts for our listeners?
I know it's going to take a greater commitment, even those with the skills and the access to the wheels of power in our world, to make progress. I mentioned earlier the importance of working locally. Yes, voting in November is critical, but my work now has increased because of the interest of the deep-seated racism in our country. And so I have received unbelievable amount of emails and messages from friends who are white and black. My career meant that most of my friends and colleagues do not look like me. And they are sincere, and I do not want ever to alienate people who have been my friends for 40 years in this business when they say, what is it I can do? And it's not putting money into an institution alone. It means putting money where it's really needed to help voting rights to be secured around the country, to help children who don't have access to computers, to help communities that are not aware of what diplomats do and why they are important, to understand why diplomacy does play a role in our everyday lives. I would tell my students at UCF in the honors program that no matter what profession you're in, IT, science, mass communications, medicine, the legal field, you may have someone seated next to you from a totally different culture who is indeed an American, who brings with him or her their cultural baggage, which can indeed enhance your ability to resolve an issue that you never even thought about before because you didn't have to be aware of it. You didn't have to function in an international setting. So it's not just IT people who have to know about other cultures. Every one of us needs to be sensitive to that. I also feel that the institutions that I've been connected with, whether it's Fletcher, whether it's Johns Hopkins, whether it's the State Department, I've had phone calls from geographic areas saying, how can we really make an impact? We now have specifics which each of us who are retired career diplomats are doing. I just got an email this morning telling us how we're going to vet certain issues with the powers that be at the State Department. That's a good sign. And I will work as long as I can to help young men and women of every race, of every color, every gender orientation, take on seriously the crucial role of diplomacy. Because I'm convinced that they can build credible and lasting relationships beyond the mask, and we can return to being that shining city on the hill.
Ambassador Elam Thomas, we thank you for being here and sharing your experiences with us. For more information on today's guests and our program, please visit us at ucfglobalperspectives.org with the Office of Global Perspectives and International Initiatives for the College of Sciences at UCF. This is Abigail Bass. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.